This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 30th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A car bomb in Netanyahu threatens the Bush administration's shuttle diplomacy in the Mideast. Some wealthy Americans don't believe the president should be cutting their estate taxes. And the FCC fines KABU Radio in Oregon for playing a hip-hop revolution song. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Lawyers for Timothy McVeigh say the convicted Oklahoma City bomber is likely to seek another delay in his scheduled June 11th execution. From Denver, Sam Fuqua reports.
McVeigh's attorneys say they need more time to review 4,000 pages of FBI investigation files that were only revealed by the agency earlier this month. The documents were not provided to McVeigh's defense team during his 1997 trial. When the FBI first admitted the existence of the additional records, the U.S. Justice Department approved a one-month delay in McVeigh's execution date. But Attorney General John Ashcroft said last week he would not grant any further postponements. McVeigh will meet with his attorneys Thursday. They say it's likely he will authorize them to seek an additional delay. The lawyers will then file that request in U.S. District Court in Denver. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sam Fuqua.
Democrats are offering their own plan for helping Californians deal with the energy crunch in that state. Katja Mester reports from Oakland.
House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt was in Oakland during President Bush's visit to California. Gephardt reacted to the news that President Bush had flatly refused California Governor Gray Davis's request for price caps on wholesale power.
Sometimes presidents change their minds. The way you do that is through the people and registering their concerns in the legislature.
Gephardt was in California as a member of a congressional delegation investigating the repercussions of the energy crisis on Northern Californians. He was joined by Representatives Nita Lowey of New York, John Conyers of Michigan, and a half a dozen representatives from California. Gephardt said he is confident that the Senate's new Democratic leadership will push legislation to impose federal price caps. Californians like Ethel Scott say they're desperate for relief.
Do I pay this exorbitant energy bill or pay the rent? Do I pay this exorbitant energy bill or buy food?
For Free Speech Radio News in Oakland, I'm Katja Mester.
And supporters of Indonesian President Wahid stormed the parliament today in Jakarta, insisting that they do not want their president impeached. Under the shadow of corruption charges, Wahid said that an impeachment would tear apart the fledgling democracy, and he threatens to institute martial law and disband parliament if the legislative body goes through with their plan this week. The parliament was unmoved and approved a call to convene a special session to discuss their recommendations for the president. In order to avoid the conflict, Wahid tried to broker a power deal with Vice President Megawati, who is supported by the country's military leaders. Nothing came of the proposal, and its contents were never made public. The average Indonesian is more concerned with developing grassroots movements and worries that the media is focusing on the concerns of the elite. For most Indonesians, the worst situation would be if the unrest continues and the military resumes control. The small Puerto Rican island of Vieques, now being used as a bombing range by the U.S. Navy, has a few more famous supporters this week. Robert Knight has more from New York.
It's day two of a hunger strike by the Vieques Four, who have been visited so far by two former New York mayors, Ed Koch and David Dinkins, two members of Congress, Charlie Rangel and Nydia Velazquez, one senator, Hillary Rodham Clinton, and hundreds of demonstrators outside of Brooklyn Prison, all of them protesting a 90-day federal sentence for the Reverend Al Sharpton and 40-day sentences for New York City and state legislators Adolfo Carrion, Jose Rivera, and Roberto Ramirez for their May Day arrest at the naval bombing range in Puerto Rico. A Boston court is reviewing the case, but prosecutors say the four are a danger to Puerto Rico because they might protest again. Defense attorneys say the claim is absurd. A bail hearing is expected later this week. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Free Speech Radio News.
The worldwide human rights group Amnesty International is announcing and celebrating this week.
Today, Amnesty International releases its annual report on the state of human rights around the world. And this is the week of Amnesty's 40th birthday celebration, 40 years of protecting and promoting human rights.
That was William F. Schultz, the executive director of Amnesty International USA. Credited with starting the organization in 1961 is British attorney Peter Benenson, who wrote an appeal for amnesty about two students who were imprisoned when they toasted freedom in Peru. The organization now has close to a million members in 162 countries and territories. There will be more on Amnesty International's report coming up. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Randy Zimmerman.
Talk shows are abuzz nationwide, with commentators and callers alike discussing how Americans will be able to spend their tax refunds from the Bush administration's tax cut. But what's not often being said is the impact these cuts will have on society overall. There's one group of Americans who you might think would be rejoicing the tax cuts, considering the fact that they stand to gain the most. But they're bemoaning the direction Bush is taking the country in. Chuck Collins is with the co-founder of Responsible Wealth. He initiated the Responsible Wealth call to preserve the estate tax. It's a group made up of millionaires who think taxing the wealthy is a responsible thing to do. Chuck, why would millionaires support a call to tax themselves?
There are really three reasons. They believe that a tax on accumulated wealth is a fair tax, and even though they themselves would have to pay it, they think it's a good thing in a society where that has made them and created the soil for them to be so wealthy that they should pay a tax upon their death and transfer of assets. The loss of the estate tax would be, when it's fully phased in, a $54 billion a year hit on the Treasury. And that would be made up in cuts in services, local hospitals, education, national parks. You know, we could anticipate that. There's also a double whammy in that the estate tax is a major incentive for people to give to charity. And so a lot of the same organizations, social service organizations, religious groups, depend on gifts from charity also to do their work. So they're really going to feel themselves stretched. And it's part of, I think, an overall Bush administration agenda of just shrinking government and cutting public services and privatizing the public good. Responsible Wealth is a group of business leaders and investors, people who are in the top 5% of income and wealth holders. They believe that the society has a claim on the wealth that society's helped them grow. They think that the rules, changing the rules to eliminate the estate tax, is just a bad idea for a democracy. The Treasury Department estimates that it'll lose some $6 to $7 billion a year that would have gone to charity, particularly gifts among the very wealthy. People with like $20 million and up estates find the estate tax a real incentive to give more. What we know, and people verify this all the time, is the tax code doesn't make people generous, but it makes generous people more generous, meaning that they go and give additional gifts or they give more. And so the estate tax is a major incentive to do planning and gifting.
William Gates Sr. is a member of your organization, is he not, Responsible Wealth?
That's right. He and I drafted something called the Call to Preserve the Estate Tax, which now has 1,000 signers, people who would have to pay the estate tax but believe it should be kept and preserved. They include what I would call the millionaire next door. They're not all super wealthy. There are a lot of small business people, people with $1, $2, $3 million that they've made in an enterprise. But even they feel that eliminating the estate tax would lead to too much concentrated wealth and power, and that would actually backfire on small businesses. When the estate tax was originally established in 1915, there was a very rigorous debate about how we wanted the United States to be different than the European countries with their hereditary aristocracies and kings and queens, and that we were really going to try to be different, and that we were going to promote, at least aspire to, equality of opportunity. And concentrated wealth works against that. The proponents of a wholesale estate tax repeal have gotten a free ride. The Mars Candy family and the Gallo family and a number of wealthy families got together 10 years ago. They hired consulting firms and pollers to try to figure out how to sell the idea of repealing the estate tax, which is a tax that really only falls on the richest 1%. And they put farmers forward as their spokespeople, when in fact very few farmers ever pay an estate tax. And they just have manipulated the debate and gotten a free ride. And I think the effort of Mr. Gates and others has at least opened up a public discussion. And even though they have repealed the estate tax in 2010, we think there's a lot of time to draw attention to the dangers of repealing it and maintain it.
Chuck Collins, co-founder of Responsible Wealth. A car bomb exploded outside a high school in the northern coastal city of Netanya today, slightly injuring 6 people. The bombing and other violence threatens to undermine U.S.-mediated talks that were the Bush administration's first attempt at Mideast shuttle diplomacy. With more on the latest developments in the region, here's Raphael Kraft.
A bomb exploded today in Israel outside a high school in the northern coastal city of Netanya, likely injuring 6 people. The militant Palestinian group Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility for the attack. Violence continues also in the occupied territories, despite Ariel Sharon's call for ceasefire 8 days ago. Earlier in the day, in the Rafah refugee camp in the south of the Gaza Strip, 2 Israeli army vehicles opened fire on stone-throwing Palestinian kids, injuring 4. One of them, a 14-year-old boy, was critically injured with a shot to the chest. Again, the Israeli army immediately refused to accept the responsibility in the attack, saying they were seeking to verify the information. Ariel Sharon, who was addressing Israel's parliament today, said Israel will continue to observe what he called its unilateral ceasefire, adding that the latest Palestinian attacks made Israelis' blood boil. Yasser Arafat, who was meeting with Swedish Prime Minister Göran Persson today in Denmark, renewed his call for international observers to be dispatched to the occupied territory to protect the Palestinian people from Israeli violences, reminding that his people were still under occupation, an occupation that continues. Indeed, Israeli Housing Minister Natan Sharansky said yesterday he had approved construction bids for almost 500 new housing units in Male Adunim settlement outside Jerusalem and more than 200 near Tel Aviv. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in the Gaza Strip.
KABU, Oregon's community radio station and a former Pacifica affiliate, has been fined $7,000 by the FCC. The fine comes after a KABU hip-hop show played a song called Your Revolution by Sarah Jones. The FCC says the song contains indecent sexual language, but KABU insists the song is a feminist attack on the sexual objectification of women, often heard on commercial radio stations. Nonetheless, KABU suspended the hip-hop show and the show's DJ while the FCC reviews KABU's appeal. Mitch Jeserich files this report.
On May 17th, the Federal Communications Commission fined public radio station KABU, located in Portland, Oregon, for indecent material played on the hip-hop show The Soundbox. The FCC cited the rap song Your Revolution by Sarah Jones as containing, quote, unmistakable, patently offensive sexual references. But not so, says the former DJ of The Soundbox, Dina Barnwell. She says Your Revolution is a response to the degradation of women as sexual objects often heard in rap songs.
Your Revolution Will Not Happen Between My Thighs is a song that talks about the subjugation of women that happens in regular rap records that come out. She makes a lot of references to even the dance hall where women are basically subjected there too. You know, like, it's not going to happen with me. And by sleeping with me or subjecting me, you know, the revolution's not going to happen here. You know, the revolution's going to happen in the third eye, which is the mind.
Barnwell says that Your Revolution has socially redeeming qualities, but that the FCC doesn't seem to understand the hip-hop idiom. Several lyrics of the song are satirical takeoffs from sexually explicit songs from such artists as LL Cool J and Shaggy that were at one time played on radio stations across the country and on MTV.
Revolution will not find me in the backseat of a Jeep with LL hard as hell. You know, doing it well. You know, doing it well. Your revolution will not be you smacking it up, flipping it, or rubbing it down. Nor will it take you downtown.
The FCC refused to comment on the KABU case, but pointed to the FCC's April 6 policy statement regarding indecency on the airwaves. This document says that indecent material is, quote, language or material that, in context, depicts or describes sexual or excretory activities or organs in a patently offensive manner. But Michael Cousins, a communication lawyer and former employee of the FCC, says that the song, Your Revolution, which doesn't contain any obscene words, is a political commentary and should be protected under the U.S. Constitution.
That's an atrocious case of, or maybe it's a beautiful case of the way the enforcement powers are being misused. Because normally the types of First Amendment expression that receive the most protection are ones that involve political commentary. And political commentary about racial or ethnic stereotyping or about sexual stereotyping, sexual politics, different lifestyles, different sexual preferences, that should receive the highest protection from a constitutional viewpoint.
Cousins also says that nonprofit community radio stations like KABU do not have the money to pay FCC fines as do commercial stations. He says the commercial stations pay these fines as though they were operating costs and then continue to freely air songs with strong sexual content. This reporter took samples of five songs that aired between 8 and 8:30 p.m. on a popular San Franciscan commercial radio station. That's the same time Your Revolution was broadcast on KABU, a time when children can be expected to listen to the radio.
In the middle like moaning. Your revolution makes me wonder, where could we go if we could drop the empty pursuit of props?
Under legal advice from its lawyers, KABU Radio suspended the show Soundbox and its DJ Dina Barnwell from the airwaves while the FCC considers KABU's appeal. Barnwell believes that KABU had no other option but to suspend her, and she feels KABU is being very supportive. But she hopes that people who believe in free speech and in hip-hop will fight the FCC's attempt to limit free expression. Reporting for Free Speech News, I'm Mitch Jezerich.
I said the real revolution, you know, I'm talking about the revolution.
Human rights violations are being perpetrated in at least 149 countries around the world. That's according to a report released today by Amnesty International. The picture that emerges from the Amnesty report is one of a world where the perpetrators of human rights violations are not just government officials and state agents. It also exposes a world where globalization has led to enormous expansion and equally massive inequalities. For more on Amnesty's report during the organization's 40th anniversary week, here's Gareth Schweitzer.
On the 40th anniversary of Amnesty International's founding, the largest human rights organization in the world documented a dramatic increase in political killings in its 2001 annual report. 61 nations witnessed political murders last year, a 69% increase from the year 2000, according to William Schultz, executive director of Amnesty International.
Today, people increasingly are targeted for who they are. Discrimination, torture, disappearances, and political killings based on one's racial, ethnic, religious, or sexual identity are the new frontier for oppressors and abusers. The victims of these abuses are often society's outcasts.
In addition, Schultz noted that Amnesty International has documented human rights violations in almost every country in the world, including the United States.
Torture and ill treatment occur in 125 countries, a staggering 84% of the 149 countries that we surveyed. Prisoners of conscience were detained in 63 countries. That's 42% of the countries surveyed. Disappearances took place in 30 countries, or 20% of those surveyed, and state executions occurred in 28 countries, 19% of the countries we surveyed.
Amnesty Director Schultz also chided the United States for failing to play a stronger role in the worldwide struggle for human rights. He saw nothing surprising about the United States' unceremonious dismissal from the United Nations Human Rights Commission.
It's no wonder that the United States was ousted from the United Nations Human Rights Commission. That defeat was precipitated in part by waning U.S. influence and by double standards.
Today's Amnesty report also harshly criticized the United States for bucking the worldwide trend to abolish the death penalty. In a nation in which public officials routinely dismiss allegations of bias and inhumanity in death penalty cases, Illinois Governor George Ryan was singled out for praise for declaring a moratorium on the death penalty in his state. The United States, although widely condemned around the globe for continuing to endorse capital punishment, has been particularly critical of the human rights policies of the Chinese. Zhu Donghua, whose wife, scholar Gao Zhan, is still being detained by the Chinese, criticized the United States for not exerting more pressure on the Chinese government to release his wife.
Well, I think it's very important for the United States to use its military and economic power to stand up and speak. Otherwise, nobody gonna see this because the United States is one of the only superpower in the world, and it's obligated to do that.
In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The North American Free Trade Agreement has resulted in a massive increase in logging along the U.S.-Mexican border. And as Kent Patterson reports from the Mexican border state of Chihuahua, the increase in logging is also increasing cross-border activism.
In the northern border state of Chihuahua, widespread timber cutting is causing conflict, too. In the year 2000, the non-governmental Chihuahua Commission in Solidarity and Defense of Human Rights, COSIDAC, filed a complaint with the North American Commission for Environmental Cooperation, the panel set up under the so-called Environmental Side Agreement to the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. COSIDAC and other groups contend that the Mexican government has not adequately responded to complaints about illegal logging. This in spite of a widely touted 1997 forestry law that mandated stricter controls on the transporting and storing of timber. María Teresa Guerrero is an organizer with COSIDAC.
La producción de agua, para decirle, la producción de agua ha disminuido increíblemente. Por ejemplo,
the generation of water has gone down incredibly. For example, in 1985, the Rio Conchos Basin, which begins in the Sierra, supplied almost 60% of the water of the Rio Grande. In 1989, that amount was down to 20%. In recent years, it's gone down so terribly that Mexico and the United States now have a problem. We owe the United States water from previous years, and they're charging us. This is an indicator that the Sierra is not generating either the same quantity or quality of water. Remember that the five largest rivers of northern Mexico are born in the Sierra. They irrigate Sonora and Sinaloa, which are the most important food production zones. And the water of the Rio Grande is important for the Mexican states of Coahuila, Tamaulipas, Nuevo León, and Chihuahua, and for the state of Texas. It is important water for the farming and ranching of this region.
Que se haga un estudio de impacto ambiental. Pero ya.
A recent report by COSIDAC and the Texas Center for Policy Studies reveals that timber production in Chihuahua almost doubled during the first 4 years of NAFTA. Ironically, while Chihuahuan timber headed for U.S. sawmills, finished U.S. wood products inundated Mexico's domestic market after NAFTA lifted Mexican import tariffs. Guerrero says citizens from both sides of the border have a stake in the issue.
Yo creo que la solidaridad internacional es muy importante por dos razones. Una, porque la
international solidarity is important for different reasons. First, because the geographic location of the Western Sierra Madres has binational repercussions. The water that is generated from the Rio Conchos Basin belongs to Mexico and the United States. Besides, the Sierra Tarahumara is a corridor of wildlife that comes from the Rocky Mountains in the United States and extends into Mexico. As a geographic region, the Sierra Tarahumara does not stop at the border. It is a geographic and ecological region important to the southwestern part of the United States and northern Mexico.
And because of the proximity of the U.S. and Mexico, and because of the nature of their protests, of Rodolfo Montiel and Teodoro Cabrera's protests against logging, it has really, I think, struck a chord with Sierra Club members.
Because of the interrelationships between cross-border ecosystems, environmental activists on both sides of the border are increasingly working together. For instance, the Sierra Club's Alejandro Queral says his group is throwing its weight behind imprisoned Mexican anti-logging activists Rodolfo Montiel and Teodoro Cabrera, whom supporters say were framed up after protesting logging being done several years ago for the U.S.-based Boise Cascade Corporation. Alejandro Queral.
A lot of the more traditional Sierra Club members have come up to me after I give a presentation to their group or chapter, and have asked me, well, you know, before I didn't understand why the Sierra Club was involved in human rights issues, but now I see the connection very clearly. I mean, we're basically working on behalf of people that are trying to do exactly the same thing we've been doing for so long. And, you know, Amnesty International activists and other human rights activists, it became very natural to them. You know, these are people that have been also advocating on behalf of, you know, what they're traditionally called prisoners of conscience. But they saw the connection with these environmental activists and have actually done a wonderful job of organizing the respective cities, have taken all sorts of different actions. We've all moved beyond just doing letter writing, which is very important and has been very successful for many years. But we've gone beyond that to, you know, staging protests, talking to members of Congress, members of the State Department, meeting with ambassadors and so forth to talk about some of these cases. So the coalition has given us great strength. It has, you know, pulled together about a million, well, our organizations together represent about a million members of the United States. But it also has brought together a coalition of smaller, you know, environmental or human rights groups that are now doing the kind of work that Sierra Club and Amnesty International have put together.
Alejandro Queral directs the Human Rights and Environment Campaign of the Sierra Club. Queral and others have been working to free imprisoned Mexican activists Rodolfo Montiel and Teodoro Cabrera. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Pageant-Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.